spacecraft that we always talk about is the Mars Curiosity. That's now being pushed back to late November into December. And that was planned for August. There were some delays that pushed that back. Nothing too serious. This is WSY.
Question for Paul.
I'd like to see that get going. You know, it is an 8.5 month trip to Mars, so of course 2012 is still the scheduled date for arrival there. And this is a big thing. I wish they made two of them. You know, when they made Opportunity and Spirit, they built two. Spirit has finally failed after all these six years. It landed in 2004 and it just failed last year in March of 2010. But Opportunity is still riding around. It would be nice to have Curiosity is the name, of course, the new rover. Would have been nice to have two of them, two Mars science laboratories rolling around on Mars. At this time around 300 feet per day or whatever it might be, actually per hour. This thing's gonna fly. I think compared to it would take all day to go 100 feet. This thing could go 300 feet in an hour. Much bigger. Drop it. Much bigger. You know, it's the length of Spirit, for instance, was about 5 feet. This is twice that amount. This is about 10 feet long. To give you an idea. Height is about twice the height too. It's equivalent to a very small car. If you were to put it on Earth, it would weigh almost 2,000 pounds, around 1,800. Closer to 1,900 pounds. That's a heavy thing. I mean, that's just the spacecraft itself. You need the big Atlas. You know, we have a heavy lift vehicle now called Atlas V, and Atkinson called the 541. The 5 stands for the number 5 for the biggest Atlas. 4 is the outside solid booster rockets that attach to it. So, you know, you're going to have four external rockets to assist in the liftoff. And you need that because the total weight of this whole thing is around 8,000 pounds that actually has to get to Mars. You know, with there's more to it than the rover. You know, you have the descent stage, you've got the heat shield, the cruise stage, back shield. You know, you've got parts of this that are going to come apart when it gets to Mars. I mean, just to give you an idea, the heat shield, that's the thing that, you know, has a blade of stuff that burns off when it goes through the atmosphere. That thing weighs almost 900 pounds thick, so. And that's just the heat shield. So, collectively, you know, between all these different parts, including the lander itself, you've got to push 8,000 pounds to Mars.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
John recognizes he's going to be asking you a question in a second, Paul. Because of the delay, doesn't that create a little bit of a problem of the proper alignment with Earth and Mars? In other words, when we launch later and later, Mars is not in the right position to make a convenient trip to Mars. I'm guessing that window must be a couple of months wide. Is that true, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, it is a couple of months wide factor. If you were to look at Mars, well, you know, Dick, when you look at it through a telescope, at one point, it looks like Mars is actually going backwards, you know, from week to week or actually from day to day. You know, you'll look at it at the background of the stars, and it's always going in one direction and flying like the other planets, and all of a sudden it starts to regress and looks like it decided to go opposite in orbit. If you look, you know, have time-lapse photography, that, you know, day in, day out, or night after night, all of a sudden Mars would look like it was starting to go backwards. So, you know, if we're at that point, you know, that has an increased window at that point. I'm not sure if that's the point where we're at, but yeah, you got a couple of months. It's roughly 2-to-1. It's, I think, what, 26 or almost 27 months to our 12 months. You know, twice around for Earth, it's roughly once around for Mars. A little bit more than that, but, you know, close enough for government to work. Back to you, Dick. WS2M.
You had a question for Paul. Go right ahead, John.
Thank you, Dick. KC2WGB. Paul, by any chance, I know you're familiar with dark energy and dark matter. Have you seen the new study from NASA about dark pull, P-U-L-L? Have you read anything about that yet?
No, I haven't, John. But I know what Dick was talking about, the new instrument that was attached to the space station. One of the things that they're going to investigate is going to help look at the dark matter and dark energy. But no, this is a new one on me, John. I'll have to keep up on that one. I tend to stay with what we know. This is something new that they came out with, John. Did you get this on the website? By the way, if you go to the website, they have a new, brand new animation of what this Curiosity is going to look like when it goes to Mars. I'll tell you about that in a second. John, back to you.
Very good, Paul. What I read was there is a group of astronomers that have been for a couple of years measuring the drift of a particular large number of galaxies that seem to be all headed for the same point and being pulled by, of course, they call it dark pull. They don't know what it's doing, but this is an effect that they've really got hard numbers on, and NASA is looking into this. Also, it's related to the WMAP, where those blank spaces, or what looks cool, those blue areas, they believe that's where the alternative universe may be located. Very interesting stuff. If you find it on the website, let me know. I was not able to find it, but I know NASA's in the process. Back to you, Dick.
John, where did you first become aware of this? Was this a NPR or a PBS broadcast? Go ahead.
No, it was on a science paper that I read. It was called Evolution, and they just happened to have this descriptive article in it, and I've never heard of it before. But it is, they mentioned some people at NASA that were developing this along with these astronomers. I think there's 5 astronomers that are involved in this, and big names. So this is going to be, it seems to be dovetailing with the membrane theory, which comes after the string theory. So it all seems to be coming together.
Yeah, astronomy is an extremely interesting science. The purest science in the world in some people's mind, because it's hard to make a dollar with it, but it asks some very boggling questions about where did we come from, where did all the stuff, how did all the stuff get here, are we alone? You've heard me say for a long time that I'm convinced we're not alone. Making contact with those other guys is not going to be easy, but I'm convinced they're there. For us to think that we're the only sentient, intelligent, call it what you like, beings in this universe is, would take an awful lot of arrogance to come to that conclusion and really believe it. I got quite a bit of interest in both astronomy and at the atomic level, the molecular level and atomic level, what's going on. Let me break you off for a minute here on the subject of the Field Day operation. I visited the Lockfield Amateur Radio Club Field Day and got into a conversation that was so interesting with a bunch of people that I didn't get a chance to visit some of the other sites that I was going to go visit. And I stayed with those guys until the sunrise. And we almost settled some of the deep questions of the universe, pun intended. Mel, I wonder how the Kings County Radio Club, what was their Field Day like this year, if you happen to know. K2KEY, K2RIW.
1 second, Dick, WS2N on a Curiosity.
Yeah, go ahead. 4,000 pounds of hardware on the space, on Mars, 8,000 pounds goes there before the deorbit. Wow. And sounds like quite a process, but because the darn thing is so big and so expensive, I can see why they're only sending one, Paul, but I'm with you. We're putting a lot of eggs in one basket. Let's hope everything goes well. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, especially this, after what I saw on the animation there. If you go to NASA, it just came up, I think it's only been up a day or so, the animation of Curiosity. They have it, you know, after the Atlas is separated, back after it's gone, you know, separated from the Centaur rocket. The Centaur rocket is like the second stage. That fires twice. That gets you to altitude and eventually powerful enough to leave the Earth orbit on the way to Mars. And so they show the cruise stage and that cruise stage separation. And then like 10 minutes before they get to Mars, and I've read about this before, the animation, talk about a picture says 1,000 words, you really got to go to that. You go to NASA.gov and you'll see, I think it says New Curiosity Animation or something like that. You click on that. It goes on for a couple of minutes. But that last 10 minutes, it's nothing like, you know, the Mars rovers that are there now. You know, it came down with these big airbags and everything and bounced along the surface. I mean, I thought that was pretty tricky. After looking at this, you're going to realize why I think they need to have two vehicles to go to Mars, because chances of all of this going well is going to be, I think, a long shot. But let me drop it. They showed entering the atmosphere, and, it's, you know, it stands at 15,000 miles an hour and all of that. It's 600-foot-long parachute, 50-foot diameter parachute opening up to slow it down. But then, as it gets closer in, they show the descent stage separating. Well, actually, you know, the back of it comes off. They call that the back shield. You know, that's got the parachute attached to it. Here, the descent stage comes flying out of that. And then as it gets within a couple of miles of the surface, the descent stage has 8 rockets on it and it starts firing to slow this thing even further down. And as it gets closer to the planet, it drops down to 4 rockets. And then as you get down a little further, it shows the rover being lowered. They actually call this a sky crane. Drop it. And they show it being lowered and dangling from this thing with these rockets still firing. And now it's dangling like 30 feet below the below this thing. To me, I'm hoping the rocket exhaust doesn't foul up Curiosity. But you know, the rocket's off, kicked on an angle. It looks like almost a 45 degree angle away from the spacecraft. And this thing's dangling away. It lands on the surface, and then the rockets are still firing for 2 seconds. I mean, it's not like immediate, but it stays there for like 2 seconds, hovering over it, and then all the cables get cut. And right after the cables get cut, this descent stage with the rockets on it takes off and flies really far away from the spacecraft. And now you've got this Curiosity actually on the ground, wheels up, ready to go, nothing to roll off of. But it looks like some complicated engineering project. It's going to be terrific to watch this thing. On top of that, cameras. They have cameras on the. I think that's on the descent stage. So as it's going down, you're going to see this thing dangling below it. I think every second it fires off. I don't know, 4 or 5 shots. So it should be fun. For 2012, back to you, WS2N.
Now, one of the main things about Curiosity is that no longer requires these great big solar cells to get the power. And because Mars is roughly twice the distance away from the Sun as the Earth, it's not getting very much power. This isn't going to be powered on a nuclear power source. Got a guess as to how many watts comes out of that nuclear power source, electronic energy, how much heat, and is it good for 10 years or so, that nuclear power source? What do you think, Paul? And will that be operational in the wintertime? I think the answer might be yes, the Mars winter. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, no more shutting it down for Mars winters like they did with the other craft. Yeah, this is got the RTG, that's plutonium source, heating up thermocouplings and powering the thing. 125 watts, sir. And that's in the beginning. It tends to drop off over time. Now, this is a planned 2-year mission, but it's not like the Phoenix mission. The Phoenix went there, and they knew when it got cold. The Phoenix mission was the one that went to the northern part of Mars. And some people might not realize what I'm talking about, but that landed there and did not have wheels. It just landed there and dug things up and did a lot of science. But they knew that when the Mars winter came, that was the end of that. But this thing is different. It's big. It's got plenty of power, 125 watts. I think it's something like it's almost 3,000 kilowatt hours per day, where MER was only a half a kilowatt per day. So it's a big difference from what was up there. So looking forward to this one, Dave.
You said it, but I missed it. Did you say the total power output is 150 watts, Paul?
125, and then after 2 years, it should drop down to about 100. I was at the end. I was giving you kilowatt hours per day.
Nice numbers. So that allows them to really do things. Okay, what was the field day? Did you go to a field day operation anywhere this weekend, Paul? Go ahead.
Yes, I did. Limock. Quite a bit at Lima.
Okay, what was it like? What did you see?
I saw four alpha. I mean, it's four transmitters. And they had a nice CW setup, which I've seen before there. I don't remember seeing the PSK-31 last year. I don't remember if that was there or not, but that was there this year. And of course, they had the single sideband to multi-band that they could switch over to. Another one that they pretty much dedicated to phone, that was on 20, did a lot on that, and did some CW as well. Back to you, Dick.
I think Andy, the Bay2CDL, also set up a television transmitting site. Is that true? Go ahead.
Oh, he was there to do that. I was there to set up and then left and came back very late at night, like 9 o'clock at night. We stayed until it was almost dawn, probably around 4, not quite dawn. So I missed any demonstrations. I don't know what went on today because I didn't go back today. Back to you.
Did I hear you say you were with them until dawn, till sunrise? Is that what you're saying, Paul?
Until dawn, but we left around 4. We went in the daytime. I know we went to set up, and then and when I say we, my son-in-law is a ham as well. So then we came back. We left, then we came back at after field day started. We left, went to another field day site. And then later that day, probably around, 9 o'clock at night, went back to Limock and stayed there through the night.
And if you want to tell me, where was the other field day site you went to? What group was that?
That's right, near his house. It's Great South Bay. Very close to that one. So gone over there for quite a few years in a row to see if they make any changes over there, you know. They had that nice, something new there at that site was a four band dipole. You could put it at either like an inverted V or in the dipole, you know, dipole fashion. But, you know, I guess it's made out of EMT tubing. You know, it's a solid thing. It's pretty neat. I think it's the one made by Comet. Back to you, Dick.
Sounds good. Mel, K2KEY, if you happen to know, what was the Kings County Radio Club field day site like? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, before I begin, Dick, I meant to bring this up at the beginning. Did you see last week on PBS a program on telescopes? I look forward to seeing this program. I believe it was a two-hour production on Channel 13, and that most of it had technical difficulties. Did Eric mention anything to you recently about this in the last few days? Over.
Okay. I do remember a television program on PBS World 21-3 on the subject of 400 years of the telescope. I think it was a two-hour presentation. Is that possibly the one you saw? Because I don't know if I looked at it this week. It's a repeat. That was done a year or two ago, and I've seen it about a week and a half ago. I didn't see the one this week, but I saw that 400 years of the telescope about a week and a half ago. I didn't see it this week. Back to you, Paul. I mean, Mel, K2KEY, K2RIW.
Wanted to know if I was the only one that was getting a, sounds like a 1 kilohertz tone through a good part of the program, and with the red signs keep popping up, we're having technical difficulties. So I was just curious, that was I the only one subjected to this? Over.
Were you watching that on 13, 21, or 21-3? What channel were you watching? I'm going to guess it was 13. Is that true?
Exactly, on channel 13. And I was really... you know, I really wanted to see it from the beginning, because they told you all about these people that did all the pioneering, what they were like as youngsters and how they got involved in different projects and things. And it was a shame that it was all the really messed up the whole good part of the program, Dick. If Eric mentioned anything, if there's going to be a repeat on it, but I don't know this is a repeat anyhow of one of the other original programs. Over.
John recognized, and I do know that Channel 13, from time to time in the last week, has had audio dropping out. A couple of times that I was watching Channel 13, and for a five-minute period of time, there was no audio, and then the audio would pop in. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Good evening, Mel. Yes, Mel, I have Fios, and I was experiencing the same problem on that particular program, which I was really interested in watching. I didn't get any red sign notifications, but there was a tone that was coming on and off, plus it sounded like a bad mic cable rattling around. It was very distracting, very difficult to watch, and I have Fios, so it wasn't just over-the-air signal.
Good to know, John. So, Mel, what was Kings County Radio Club field day like this year, if you happen to know? You got it, Mel.
It was successful. You know, we're a small club. We operated 3 alpha. Unfortunately, because of circumstances, I wasn't able to spend as much time there as I usually do. But I was able to get there Saturday and just make sure that make sure the antennas, everything went up, electrically, everything got working. And then, unfortunately, for my circumstances, I had to go, you know, take off, and then came back this morning and made sure that I stayed with them through the final hours and all, and make sure that everything got dismantled properly, put away properly, and, you know, so that was my participation. About a bit abbreviated, but I surely pushed myself really to get there this year, and I enjoy it as always, and they're a great bunch of guys that... of course, we're at Building 272. Ryan Visitor Center, unfortunately, is still, I don't know what's going on there, but it surely looks like a long way off for before it'll be reopened over.
Does anybody have a guess as to when the Ryan Visitor Center might reopen, or is that completely right now up in the air, pun intended?
B2BXL.
Hey, there's our chief operator, Frank, so maybe he can shed some more light on it, Dick, over.
You got it, Frank.
Okay, yeah, I wouldn't keep my hopes out and stuff. It sounds like the whole area is being commercialized, so you probably heard it as you were packing up the stuff. Somebody who seems knowledgeable came by and told us that the whole area was being converted into a commercial campground. Maybe a park service campground, maybe it's not technically commercial. So it sounds like it's going to be harder and harder to get in there. So, I don't know. One thing I will say is that, Mal, as you know, your antennas worked just about flawlessly. The only issue I noted was the one I pointed out was some interaction between the two stations because we had to bring the two cables in through the same window. But the antennas loaded perfectly. I was just amazed by how well those limited antennas worked. There's certainly a lot of stuff we weren't hearing that the guys with beams were hearing and working. But still, for wire antennas, it was darn good. Let me just let it drop a minute. Yeah, and I think after you left Saturday, Tony ran some PSK-31. I haven't looked at the logs yet to see how many contacts he made. I know he made at least two, which is not very much, but considering the limited power he was running on the 10-meter station, and that he was on 10 meters, not 20, he did well with that. He was demonstrating the latest software, the number of data streams he could take in at once, and how it could even show him which data streams were actually CQs, even though they weren't tuned into that. We also had a visit late at night from Alan, N2KW, who I believe is a member of LIDXA and possibly LIMAR. And somebody looked at the computer and thinks he made about 150 contacts, which I may be able to back out and verify later on. So I think he was really the lead operator this time. And as you know, he is in fact one of the preeminent operators in this area. But that was a pleasant surprise. I haven't seen him in about 30 years, I think. Anyway, with that, go ahead, Dick. WB2BXL.
Revine, Frank, and thank you for that report. Anyone else who went to a field day site this weekend, who's within the sound of our voice right now, who wants to tell us what you saw or what it was like, give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2ZUM.
KC2ZUM. Start off with your name, sir, and which field day site, and what was it like? Your name is?
Good evening. The name here is Alan. Saturday, I was at the Great South Bay Amateur Club field day, and today I was at the LIMAR. First time for me doing this. I found it very interesting to see people operating at different modes and different equipment and different tents. Got pretty much bitten up by the mosquito, but I met a lot of, finally got to meet people that I've been talking to for the last 6 months on the air on different repeaters. Found it to be very interesting and found people to be most helpful and friendly and something I'm looking forward to attending other events, other that are coming up in the future. And that's pretty much it. KC2ZUM.
Glad to hear all that, Alan. Alan, which group had the most amount number of mosquitoes? Great South Bay or LIMAR? Who had more mosquitoes? Crazy question, but go ahead, Alan.
I would have to say the Great South Bay, and I think that was because the night before it had rained and the ground was still kind of damp, and I did not use any kind of repellent, but that's to be expected in the outdoors. Back to you.
Yeah, I think when mosquitoes attack you is also a big factor of what time of the day, and I think they really like like dusk time. And I believe the way they detect the presence of a human being is they sense the moist, warm air coming off your body as they fly over you. And that tells them where you are, even in the dark. So I think they detect that more than visual. And for the most part, their eyesight is very good. They're very good at avoiding a slap from the hand. Anyone else went to a field day site and wants to tell us what it was like? Give me a call, letters and name right now, KQRIW.
I think the detection is by CO2, Dick.
Could very well be. Anyone else with field day information? And most of these guys stay up for some ridiculous hours at field day, so they're probably all resting up right now. My days and nights got pretty mixed up because I was with the group at Lockfield until the sun rose. Reminds me of the old college days when people used to work around the clock studying for test exams and so on. Okay. I guess we've got some individual questions. Oh, I forgot to get that list off my printer. I'll go get that list. I'll be hearing what you've got to say, John, when I turn it over to you as to what the first deep question of the night will be. KC2WGB. I'll be back in about 60 seconds, but I'll hear you. K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, very good. I've gone further with my capacitor testing, and I haven't assembled enough data, but I've discovered something very strange about those large capacitors. I've started to work with a non-polarized bathtub capacitor and a combination with a normal electrolytic capacitor, and they were 5,000 mic for the electrolytic, and the non-polarized was a 13 microfarad, and I spaced them approximately a third of a meter apart and was feeding signal into one and picking up the signal coming out of the other one. That was kind of interesting. I'm assembling data now from some empirical numbers from the equipment, and I will be talking to you as soon as I develop a way to describe exactly what I'm experiencing. It was very strange, and the gain is even higher than the one with the wire wrapped around it. Really silly stuff.
KC2QIQ, the question this evening?
No, you can't have a question.
You got it, Glenn.
Actually, my question tonight, Dick, is in the past we've discussed slotted antennas, you know, where you basically take a piece of sheet metal and you have a slot inside of it and you create an antenna. And actually, I've been kind of looking into that, and it's very interesting. The only thing that really boggles my mind right now is how do you couple a feed line to it? Okay, in other words, okay, now you've got this structure with a slot in it, and now you want to connect a piece of coax and use it as an antenna. How is it matched? I've been trying to look that up in books anywhere. I can't seem to find any information on it. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, we have been discussing slot antennas and Babnitz rule. In other words, there's a duality of all the antennas that you know. There's an inverse antenna. Every place where you've got free space, that's an insulator, you substitute it with a sheet of metal. Every place where you've got an antenna, you substitute it with a slot in the sheet of metal. So a slot antenna, in its basic form, is a fairly large sheet of metal, and you'll find out eventually you can start making that sheet of metal smaller and smaller, as you start moving in the direction of what's called a skeleton slot antenna. But that's another discussion. And the slot is a half wavelength long. The two ends of the slot are essentially a short circuit. The center of the slot is where the maximum voltage is developed. At one instant of time, the center upper half of the slot, assume it's a horizontal slot giving you a vertically polarized wave. Assume the slot is, let me make it a 2-meter antenna, so let me make the slot 38 inches long. Let's go to 432. Let's go to 915 megacycles. 915 megacycles with a wavelength of 12.9 inches. Half of that is a little bit over 6 inches. So I've got a slot in a sheet of metal, and the slot is horizontal, and it's 6 inches long. Half wavelength at roughly 915 megs. The 902 to 928 megacycle ham band, as well as other license-free equipment, is there. Stand by. and the hams tend to dwell at the low end of 902 megacycles because they know that the frequency hopping license-free equipment has some very strict requirements as to how much energy is allowed to flow out of the band, and therefore most of the designers of that equipment don't use the lowest of frequency of the 50 slots that are there, of the 50 frequency slicers. So the hams can locate themselves at the lower one and experience very little interference. At one instant of time, this 6-inch long slot, 3 inches from each end, the upper half of it, of this horizontal slot, is going to be positive and the lower half is going to be negative in the center. That's the voltage distribution, so to speak. And it's a half sign of distribution of voltage magnitude versus position along that slot. If you fed a piece of coax cable, if you took a piece of coax cable and lay it flat to the sheet metal, starting off at the 6 o'clock position down at the bottom, and this flat piece of coaxial cable, you connect the shield to the center, to the lower end of the copper slot, connect the center conductor across the slot, and solder it down to the upper half of the slot. You do that, and you would have a feed impedance of around 2,000 ohms. As you start taking that piece of coax cable that I just described and sliding it further and further to the left shorted end or the right shorted end, the impedance comes lower and lower. And if you mounted that piece of coax cable, I'm going to make a guess, 1 inch from the right-hand end, and you put the piece of coax cable across that slot, as I just described, you would have approximately 50 ohms. And as long as the slot is the right length, it would be non-reactive. If the slot was a little bit too short, you can always create a stray capacitance. Let me drop. You can always create a stray capacitance across the center of the slot with pieces of copper tape. Put some scotch tape around the center of the slot on the lower half of the sheet metal, or below the slot. Connect your piece of copper tape across the upper half of the slot, and it starts overlapping a little bit at first the scotch tape at the lower end, and as you adjust that by bending with a wooden stick that piece of copper tape that I just described, you could probably take a slot that was resonating at 915, and you could probably move it down to 870 megacycles by just putting a piece of tape across it. And the impedance of the transmission line at each of those resonant frequencies would be pretty close to resistive. It would slowly change, but that's part of a... So you tune the impedance by sliding the cable. You tune the slot by either adjusting the length of the slot or a straight capacitance across the center. Your first question is going to be, how come if I lay my piece of coax cable flat to the copper and I'm launching currents and voltages into the sheet of copper, aren't I launching a whole lot of signal onto the outside of the coax cable? And the answer is almost no. Let me drop. The slot itself is launching currents and voltages into that sheet of metal, and nearby to the slot, yes, there's a significant amount of voltage on the sheet metal. Assuming the sheet metal was, in my example, a 1 foot square, and you bring the coax cable down to the lower edge and either do or don't solder it, the amount of signal that will be on the outside of the coax cable will be fairly small, and if that bothered you, you put a couple of loops in that coax cable as it leaves the sheet of metal, and that's a poor man's RF choke. So once you understand the theory of operation of the slot, and once you look at, I just shown you the most basic, simplest way of feeding the slot. There's all kinds of ways of feeding it with hybrids and whatever, directional couplers and hybrids and power splitters and so on. But that's the most basic, easy way of feeding it, and it'll give you 98% efficiency, if you know what I mean, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Questions?
Wesley, stand by a minute. Glenn first, go ahead.
That's fascinating. I never thought it was really that simple. So, in other words, you're going to basically take the shield and the center conductor, and you're going to, I guess, it's going to be, I would imagine these connections have to be very, very close to the edge of the slot and on the same side of the slot, right? In other words, you'd never want to have it across the slot. In other words, you probably want to have it on one side. Am I correct in that understanding? Let's say if the piece of of flat metal is completely copper, so I can solder directly to it. And I'm on one side of the slot. The closer I bring the two leads to the center with the coax flat across the, perpendicular to the coax coming up perpendicular to the slot, but the shield, you know, I guess you'd probably have to insulate the shield coming away from the coax center and then just basically shield it to where it's attached and then solder it down and do the same thing moving up. So in other words, you're on one side of the slot. Is that correct, Dick? K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I think the answer is no, Glenn. Let me start off with a 1 square foot of copper foil, copper tape. I got some wide copper tape, and some of the roll of copper tape I bought was the 5-inch wide roll, and I lay a couple of strips down that overlap slightly. So I created a 1 foot square, just for this experiment, 1 foot square. I've laid the copper tape down onto some foam, or I could lay it down onto wood or whatever. So it's a 1 square foot, and maybe I soldered those edges where it overlapped just to be a purist. You wouldn't really have to, but that's another whole story. I get out my Stanley knife, and I cut a horizontal slot that is approximately 6 1/4 inches long in the middle of this 1 foot square, and I use the Stanley knife twice so that I cut out an amount of copper that is an 8-inch wide strip that's 6 1/4 inches long. And just to be pretty, I round off the edges a little bit of where I did the cutting. So I got an 8-inch wide slot, 6 1/4 inches long. I take my piece of semi-rigid, I take my piece of ordinary coaxial cable, which has got an outer insulation on it, wouldn't really matter, and I lay it flat across the copper, not perpendicular to the slot, not perpendicular to the copper, I lay it flat across the copper. I start off at the center, let's see now, because I'm feeding it 1 inch from the right-hand edge of the copper, I'm roughly five inches to the right of center. I'm coming in from the bottom. I'm laying the coaxial cable flat against the copper. I connect it to the copper in the vicinity of 1 inch away from the right-hand side of the slot, and the shield is soldered down.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The shield is soldered down very close to the lower edge of this 8-inch wide slot. The center conductor with its insulator bridges the 1-inch gap across the slot, and the center conductor right above where the shield at the lower half is attached, the center conductor is now soldered to the copper on the upper edge of the slot, 1 inch from the right-hand side. So the center conductor and shield are bridging the gap. The coax cable is parallel everywhere to the copper. Whether or not I strip away some of the insulation on the outside of the coax cable and solder it down to the outer perimeter of the copper tape, that's optional. I could do that, but I could not do that. So the copper, the coaxial cable can come off the copper tape thoroughly parallel to the copper tape everywhere, or I could come off at right angles. In other words, the sheet of copper tape and it's the foam is laying flat on the table. I'm looking straight down at it, and if I wanted to, I could bring the coax cable away straight up toward my eye if you wanted to. But I could lay it flat to the copper, and it would make very little difference. In either case, if I want to be a purist, I'm going to put some ferrite beads on that coaxial cable, or a coil. I'm going to coil the coax cable a couple of turns as it leaves that outer edge of the copper tape. So because of the voltage distribution that exists across that slot, the voltage is highest in the center, lowest at the edges. All I've got to choose is the right position along the slot where I put the coaxial cable bridging the slot. And I could have fed it with twin lead, by the way. And everything would be almost the same, except now I would really bring the transmission line away from the copper tape at a normal direction. But I could have fed it with twin lead. So is it making a little more sense, Glenn first, KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
It is, except the part that's still not clear to me is it sounded to me as if you were soldering the shield, in other words, you stripped off the outer insulation, and I guess you must have stripped back some of the shield, and you soldered the shield to the bottom of one side of the slot, and then It sounds to me as if you took the insulation still covering the center conductor and moved it some length up the slot from where the bottom shield is being soldered and attached it somewhere up the slot until you got to the 50 ohm mark. Is that closer? In other words, I'm having a little trouble understanding where and how the coax is being physically soldered along the slot. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
The answer is no again. Assume now that I've stripped away the insulation on the outer braid, and I've soldered the braid down to the lower edge of the slot, 1 inch from the right-hand side. The center conductor, I leave some of its insulation there for 1/8 of an inch, and now I've stripped away the insulation on the center conductor, and the center conductor is soldered down to the upper portion of the slot in the exact same location, 1 inch from the right-hand side. So the total amount of center conductor that is exposed outside of the braid is approximately an inch long. An eighth of an inch long. I made the slot an eighth of an inch in this example. Therefore, the total length of center conductor outside of the braid is roughly an eighth of an inch. And it's bridging the gap. In other words, in the case of the horizontal slot, the coaxial cable in every location is a pure vertical piece of coax cable up and down, parallel to the copper, everywhere parallel to the copper. And the center conductor that's exposed outside of the braid is the shortest possible length, bridging the 1/8 inch gap. So if the braid is soldered 1 inch from the short circuit on the right-hand side, the center conductor is soldered 1 inch from the short-hand side. Center conductor versus braid are creating a voltage across the gap. Make a little more sense now, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Okay, gotcha. So in other words, between the center conductor and the shield is 1 inch, and you're going across that gap. Okay, that part I get now. Now, where are you going across the gap? Towards the center of the slot or towards one side of the slot?
No again, Glenn. Stand by. I start off with a piece of coax cable that's going to go across the slot. I strip away a little bit more than an eighth of an inch. I strip away a quarter of an inch of the outer insulation on the braid. And I open up the braid. I've now got a little bit more than an eighth of an inch of exposed center conductor plus its insulation. A quarter of an inch of the center conductor plus its insulation is exposed outside of the braid. I've got a 6 1/4 inch long horizontal slot, and the slot itself, I've used the Stanley knife twice so that the slot is an eighth of an inch wide, 6 1/4 inches long, and it's horizontal. I take my straight edge, I locate the straight edge in a vertical manner, I lay it down on the copper, I slide this vertical straight edge flat on the copper, I slide it left and right until there's 1 inch of slot exposed to the right of my straight edge. I take my pencil and I draw a vertical pencil line. That vertical pencil line across the slot is 1 inch from the right-hand shorted end of the slot. I take this piece of coax cable. I lay it on that vertical pencil line. I've drawn the vertical pencil line across the whole darn 1 square foot of copper. And I've drawn it in a location left and right. It's a vertical line, pencil line. And I've made that pencil line 1 inch from the right-hand side of this horizontal slot. I take the piece of coax cable. I lay it parallel to that pencil line.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I lay it parallel to the pencil line on the lower half of the copper foil. I slide it vertically so that the braid is now right over the pencil line, just below the slot. The center conductor is parallel to the copper, perpendicular to the slot, The center conductor is bridging the 1/8-inch slot. Center conductor of the transmission line is now soldered down to the pencil line that's above the slot, right as close to the slot as I can get it. So the braid of the slot is right at the edge of the slot, below the slot. The braid is connected there. The center conductor is at the exact same location, left and right, right above the slot, an eighth of an inch away. There's an eighth of an inch of total exposed center conductor of coax cable. Braid is in that location, also just below the slot. The rest of the coax cable is parallel to the pencil line, coming off the bottom of the copper foil. You get the picture. Over to you, Glenn.
Okay, the only thing I'm not getting here, maybe I'm not following this 100%, is, okay, I've got the slot, I've got the coax, I understand that the coax now is only exposed an eighth of an inch, and you're soldering. The problem is the one-inch line is, with respect to the slot, where is the one-inch line with respect to the slot? Is it 1 inch from the bottom of the slot to the side of the slot? In other words, I'm not following where this is parallel to the slot, perpendicular to the slot. I'm not getting where that line is with respect to the slot.
Okay. Once again, I've got copper foil that's 1 square foot laying on some wood. I've taken my Stanley knife with a horizontal straight edge, and I've cut a horizontal slot 6 1/4 inches wide, as close as I can get to the center. I slid the horizontal straight edge an eighth of an inch down, and I used my Stanley knife again. So now I've taken away an eighth of an inch wide strip of copper, 6 1/4 inches long, and it's a horizontal slot that I just created. I take a straight edge, and instead of it being horizontal, I take the exact same straight edge. I rotate it 90 degrees. The straight edge is flat against the copper. The straight edge is now at right angles to the slot. The whole straight edge is 1 foot long, and it's flat against the copper, and it's perpendicular to the slot. And I take the straight edge, and I slide it left and right so that the total straight edge, the right-hand edge of the straight edge, is 1 inch away from the right-hand edge of the slot. A vertical straight edge, flat against the copper, perpendicular to the slot, 1 inch away from the right-hand shorted end of the slot, and I'm now going to draw a 1-foot-long pencil line with the right-hand edge of that straight edge. Does that make sense so far? Go ahead.
So the way it sounds to me now is you have a 6-inch slot that's relatively near the center, a 6-inch slot, 1/8 inch wide, and now you're making perpendicular line across the slot that's 1 inch from the bottom. So from that line to the bottom, you've got 1 inch, and you've got 5 inches to the top of the slot. Is that correct?
No. 1 square foot of copper braid, copper foil. Horizontal straight edge. I start off with a straight edge parallel to the lower edge of this 1-foot square.
Is the line below the slot?
I then take that straight edge and move it vertical to the center of the 1 square foot of sheet metal. With the Stanley knife, I cut into the copper foil a 6 1/4 inch long slot, horizontal, near the center. I take that horizontal straight edge, I move it vertically down an eighth of an inch, and I use the Stanley knife again. I've now made 2 cuts into the copper, and I remove that piece of copper. I have to do a small vertical cut, an eighth of an inch long on the right-hand side, a small vertical cut, eighth inch long on the left-hand side. I'm left with a rectangular cut in the copper that's major dimension is 6 1/4 inches horizontal. Its vertical dimension is 1/8 inch. I now take that same straight edge. I rotate it 90 degrees while it's still flat against the copper. and I'm now going to slide it left and right. I'm going to keep it parallel against the copper. It's a 1 foot long straight edge. It's parallel to the copper. It's at right angles to the slot, and I'm sliding it left and right. If I slide it 3 1/8 inches to the right of center, the right-hand edge of the straight edge will be touching the right-hand end of the slot. I take that vertical positioned straight edge, perpendicular to the slot, I'm keeping it parallel to the copper tape. I'm now going to slide it to the left 1 inch.
To the left from where, Dick? The left from where? I don't understand where you're starting with the straight edge. That's the problem.
Dick, use plan view description. It'll be easier for him.
I told you I had this vertical straight edge in the center. I slid it to the right until the right-hand edge of the straight edge is right at the location of the right-hand edge of the slot. In other words, where I did that vertical eighth of an inch cut on the right-hand side of the slot to remove the copper, the straight edge is now at that location. The straight edge is everywhere perpendicular to the slot. The straight edge is everywhere flat against the copper. The right-hand edge of the straight edge is right at the place where I did. In fact, that's the way that I did the vertical cut at eighth of an inch long on the right-hand side of the right-hand edge of the slot. And I haven't moved the straight edge yet. Do you know where the straight edge is right now? Over to you, Glenn.
Oh my God! I must be so stupid tonight. I really don't. Is the straight edge now in line or parallel to the slot, or is it perpendicular to the slot, going across the slot? Which direction is it? I'm lost here.
I said it multiple times. I used the straight edge to cut the two horizontal slots an eighth of an inch wide to make the cuts in the copper. I then took that straight edge, rotated it 90 degrees. The straight edge is perpendicular to the slot.
Perpendicular and across the slot?
Roger. The straight edge is perpendicular to the slot, across the slot. It's always going to stay from now on perpendicular to the slot, flat against the copper. And I'm going to slide it to the right-hand side, and I'm about to make that eighth of an inch cut at the right-hand side of the slot, because I'm trying to make a slot 6 1/4 inches long. I've made the two horizontal cuts an eighth of an inch away from each other. I still got to cut some copper on the right-hand side and the left-hand side, defining it to be 6 1/4 inches long. I've done this. I've slid this straight edge to the right 3 1/4 inches from center. I'm about to make the vertical eighth of an inch cut on that piece of copper so I can remove it. So do you have a feeling for where the straight edge is at this instant? Over to you, Glenn.
So right now I have a slot. It's 6 inches long, horizontal across, and there's 1/8 of material missing from it. So it's 1/8. The dimension of the slot is 1/8 of an inch thick, right? And it's 6 inches long. Okay. Now you have the straight edge perpendicular going across the slot right now. Now I need to know, where is the straight edge from? Is it near the center, so it's one side, or to the left-hand side or to the right-hand side, because it's a horizontal slot?
The horizontal slot is 6 1/4 inches long. After I made the two horizontal cuts, I had to make a eighth of an inch long cut at the right-hand side of the slot. I had to make an eighth of an inch long cut at the left-hand side of the slot. Those two vertical cuts, eighth of an inch long each, are 6 1/4 inches from each other. At the instant of time that I made the right-hand edge of the slot eighth of an inch long cut, I did it with that perpendicular straight edge. The straight edge went across the slot. The straight edge is parallel to the copper. It's a 1 foot long straight edge. It goes from the top to the bottom of this 1 foot square copper. I used the straight edge to make that cut neatly on the right-hand side of the slot to begin the process of removing the copper that's going to be 6 1/4 inches long. I haven't moved the copper again to make the left-hand cut. I've just made the right-hand cut with the Stanley knife, using that straight edge to make the right the eighth of an inch cut on the right-hand side of the slot. Does that make some sense so far? Go ahead.
Yes, it does, because what I have in my mind right now is a slot that's one eighth of an inch thick by 6 inches long. And that's where you are right now, right?
Yes, I am. And I had to make two vertical cuts.